Before the traveler, our traveler with the magic rocks, our traveler with the plan to draw people together, before our traveler became old and wise and clever, he was young and foolish and naive. This is the way it happens sometimes, although not always. The traveler, Eli short for Elihu, or maybe Eli, a contraction of the name of his mother's favorite poet, Emma Lazarus, author of Mother of Exiles, give me your tired, your poor, I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Eli wanders through the world. He has a sense of, well, entitlement, that the world is designed for him and that he deserves it, that things should be a certain way. Eli wanders through the world with a kind of charmed existence. He goes places and tries things, but he does it from a distance. You know, always kind of judging others. Cultural encounter as a kind of adventure, a tourist in the lives of others and not really a guest. I don't mean to be harsh about Eli. He was young and foolish, and he just hadn't learned very much yet. And in his defense, he was at least interested in the world outside his door. He did want to learn and discover, but in this world, he was the host, the one who set the table for others, never the guest, not really. Well, one summer, he decided to go on a long hike in an unfamiliar place. He was in good shape. He was sure he could do it solo. The first few days were great, beautiful country, and all was well. But then a big thunderstorm rolled in, and he got soaked. His food got wet even, and things started getting desperate. He was scared. When the storm broke, he picked up what he could, and he kept going, but it was hard. Squish, squash went his shoes. And after a long, hard, hungry day, he saw something in the distance as the sun set, a campfire, and he approached. He was intentionally noisy, so he wouldn't frighten them, you know, big footsteps. There was a small group of folks roasting s'mores and telling stories. And they saw him, and one stood up and sang, "Stranger, share our fire." Eli didn't realize he was living in a musical, but he thought that must be the hunger speaking. But then they all stood up and they sang together, "Stranger, share our fire." Maybe it was a choir on a camping trip. He approached and they gave him a cookie, powdered sugar and dates and nuts. And they gave him hot tea and bread and veggie stew. And they said, "This is all we have. It is what we offer you." And Eli had this moment, you know, when you're not really proud of yourself and because of what you've thought. He thought, "Bread and veggie stew, really? Don't they have any meat?" And he thought, "Tea? I could really use a beer." He did not say these things. He was not that rude. But he thought them. And they sang, "It is all we have ourselves. It is what we offer you." And he looked at them. And gratitude overcame his entitlement. And he said, "I don't know how to thank you. You've saved me in more ways than you know." And they said, "Sit and eat. Say thank you, but that's enough." So he did. And he slept under the stars and he dried his clothes by the fire and he thanked them again with sincerity but simplicity in the morning and has made his way back into the world. This moment was the beginning of a shift in Eli's world. It didn't happen all at once, but he began to think more about what it meant to be a good guest, to have a less entitled view of the world and his place in it, to be more grateful and accepting. He was astonished at himself that he could have walked into that campfire in such a place of need and then still wanted more. And he began to think about what it would mean when someone said, "Stranger, share our fire." here is what we have to offer you, and to say yes and thank you, and that's it. This is the world he wants to live in. He decides this is the world he wants to live in. So he tries. He goes places and accepts what is offered with sincere but simple gratitude. He discovers that many people find meaning in being good and gracious host and want to do it. And he always offers that they can stay with him, or that he will take them to dinner if they ever come visit him when he is at home. And some do, which is lovely. He learns the rules of the places he is going. In suburban America, he always brings a bottle of wine. In France, he stops at the bakery and gets a fresh loaf of bread. In other places, he brings flowers or a little gift, a little something for the cauldron of hospitality. He's becoming slowly the wise traveler. One day, he's browsing a little free library, you know, those things, and he sees a book called How to Be a Perfect Stranger. He's delighted by the title and grabs it. It turns out, to his surprise, that it's about religion. Had it. He hadn't given religion a lot of thought, to be honest. Each chapter of the book discusses a different religion and how to be a guest when you visit them, and whether that visit is to a regular worship service, or Sunday morning, or Friday midday, or whenever it is, or that visit is for a wedding, or a memorial, or an initiation service, or something like that. It's a very practical book. What will happen when you are there? What do you wear? As a guest, what are you expected to do and to not do? Eli is amazed at the differences just in the sections about Christianity, let alone all the other religious traditions of the world. One thing he reads really strikes him. The authors say, "Do not pretend to be a member of the faith you are visiting. Don't try to keep up with the kneeling or the singing or the ritual. Don't pretend that you understand the deep meaning of the prayers or what it means to the believers. Just be respectful. They don't want you to pretend to be one of them. They're glad that you are there to visit. Be respectful, but don't fake it. It isn't yours, at least not yet, so don't act like you own the tradition. Be a guest." This is liberating to him and reminds him of the simple power of asking questions, of not presuming when he goes places. "Tell me what matters to you," he has found is a question that works. And then to listen. "Let me tell you what I think of your experience," is not such a good sentence. So he thinks to himself, after reading this book on religion, "I should go visit these places." So he starts visiting various religious communities. Sometimes he takes off his shoes. Sometimes he takes off his hat. Sometimes he borrows a hat so he can go in. He is respectful. When the congregation is invited to sing together, he gives it a try. When they speak the prayer they have memorized for generations, he just listens. When they take communion, he watches. When they clap, he does too. When they stay silent, he stays silent. There is, he notes with gratitude, all kinds of people around these welcome tables. He is the guest, not the host. But he sees that the people see themselves too as the guest of the holy, of the ancestors, of the spirits of the earth itself. One Sunday morning, some years after his night by the fire with the strangers, and years after he'd started visiting various religious communities on his journey, he found himself in a small country church. You know, one of those with the little white clapboard places with the big oak tree in front and all the cars scattered on the grass, parked every which way. It was surprisingly a multiracial congregation, which is unusual anywhere, but he was really surprised to find it in a small rural place. And they were very friendly people. And he enjoyed his time with them. After the service, Eli stuck around for cheese and crackers and apple juice and was grateful. The pastor, a gray-haired beanpole of a woman with wire-rimmed glasses and a twinkle in her dark brown eyes, approached him. She struck up a conversation, and he was happy to chat. He asked about the church, and she showed him the one stained glass window they owned over the chancel, a multiracial Last Supper. The disciples gathered guests in the upper room. The room, she said, was probably owned by Joseph of Arimathea. Jesus himself was a guest there and understood what it meant to be a guest, to accept the hospitality of others, even of tax collectors and prostitutes and Samaritans. For what, after all, does it mean to be a neighbor, but to take another into your home when they are in need and to be taken in when you are in need? To see one another as a mutual guest in the world. The pastor, she wasn't that good with names, so at some point she asked, "Tell me your name again." "Eli," the traveler said. And though he almost never said so, he added on this occasion, "It's short for Elihu." She looked at him. He added, "I don't know where Elihu comes from. I guess it was a relative or something." She looked again. He wondered if she was going to start to sing. It was that kind of moment, and then she did. Here in the silence, may our hearts be open. Open to feeling human pain and sorrow. Open to healing, mending the tomorrow. Moved by the silence here. He recognized the song as what the quartet had sung that morning. They just had a quartet. It was a small church. He guessed he was living in a musical again. She said, "Elihu is an interesting name. It comes from the oldest book and the most confounding and difficult book in the Bible." Eli is startled. He did not know this. His parents never told him. He says, "Tell me." The pastor says, "It's complicated. And we could spend years trying to understand, and probably never would. I told you it was confounding. But the short of it is this. In the book of Job, Job is righteous, but suffers greatly. And three friends come and they try to explain it. There's a question Job asks, why does evil happen? That is the most ancient question and the most relevant, isn't it? Eli thinks about the news that week, and a tear runs down his cheek, and he says, "Yes, that is the question, isn't it? Why does evil happen?" Pastor reaches out and touches him on the arm for a moment, and then she explains the story. Three friends come to Job, and they say, "You must have done something to deserve it." Job insists that he has not. He has been righteous. And we, the reader and listener of the story, know that Job is right. He has not done wrong, but they insist you must have done something. And after 31 chapters of this, back and forth, it's long, a new character appears as if out of nowhere, Elihu. And he says to the friends, "Why do you try to blame Job?" And he says to Job, "Why do you try to blame God? It just is. There is just evil in the world, and when it strikes us," says Elihu, "we are not to blame the victim or to say that God is punishing us, but instead we are to comfort each other, to sit in the silence and open our hearts, and yes, mend the tomorrow, but not to explain it away as if the pain isn't real or the suffering isn't real, or as if it is the world is always fair and just, for it is not." "I'm drastically oversimplifying," says the pastor, "but that's the gist of it." She says, "Elihu sees us as the guests of God, subject to God's mercy and not in control of our own fate." The truth is, she says, a lot of people read Job and they decide they can never believe in that God. Some days, some weeks, that includes me. But there is something about Elihu, self-righteous though he is, that I've always loved. His sense that there aren't always answers. And that if you don't lament the tragedy, you can't solve it. Pain that isn't transformed is transmitted. They're silent for a moment. She clears her throat. "Forgive me," says the pastor, "I must go now to the caring committee meeting, though it is lovely to meet you." And Eli thanks her and puts his pack on his back and walks out into the beautiful fall day. There are a lot of years that go by between this day and the day the traveler shows up in the village with his magic rocks. During those years, Eli learns more and more about being a good guest and about being a perfect stranger. At some point in his journey, he takes a workshop in something called Intercultural Developmental Inventory, which is a lot of syllables. He learns about the stages of intercultural competence, of all things. It sticks with him. The first stage is denial, living in a bubble, and Eli is glad he was never really there, but some are. The second stage is us versus them thinking. And he remembers how he was a traveler when he was younger, always thinking his way was right and others were exotic and interesting, but that he was normal. He's past that now. The third stage, minimization, thinking we're all really the same deep down and that culture doesn't matter or make much of a difference. And he's been there, but he wasn't there very long. Because to open yourself to the stories and lives of your hosts is to know that culture does matter and difference does matter. And then there's acceptance, realizing nobody is normal and nobody is right. And seeing difference is real and beautiful. And then finally, adaption. Being able to be, from deep in your bones, a good guest in a culture that's not your own. Not faking it. Being respectful. Curious and interested and open. Letting the silence move us. And accepting the gift that is shared with grace and gratitude. There are other experiences in Eli's life of both of being a guest and of being a host, of the give and take of being a neighbor. There is a day at the airport when a flight is delayed and out of the corner of his eye, he sees at another gate with another delayed flight, children handing out apple juice to passengers who seem to be covered in all things with powdered sugar. He thinks about the apple juice served at church that day and about the legacy of pain and compassion and about the grace of accepting a gift and the beauty of offering it. He thinks about what it means to be a guest to another person's life, to be welcomed into their heart, their sorrow, their joy, their very being of being human, to share their fire. The fire of their spirit. He thinks about what it means to see one another clearly and about the world where we are all guests, each and every one of us wayward souls, the world where we are in need of one another to mourn together, to dance together, to love, to mend, to heal, to hope, to plan, to share. To eat each other's cooking and call it good. To say thank you with sincerity and simplicity. He thinks about the world we share, and he thinks about us all and how we are so fragile, how existence is tender, and how we need, and how we can offer, and that we do, sometimes we do, and how beautiful that is. And how not everything is lost. And how this, the world of gracious acceptance, this world is the world we want to live in. Leaving the village that day after he had helped them make phone soup, began to hum a tune, an old tune, something from Southern Harmony, a song about love, about grief, and about friendship, and how a loving guest can bring us back to ourselves, and how we might sing with thanks unto the end. And he put on his pack, and he walked out the door into the beautiful fall day. Let us sing together. I extinguish our chalice, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These things we carry with us until we are together again. While I do that, I invite you, if you wish to, join hands with one another for our blessings and benedictions. Take courage, friends. The way is often hard, the path is never clear, and the stakes are very high. Take courage, for deep down there is another truth. You are not alone. We'll sing together our closing blessing. We'll sing it through twice.